because they left it.
Because
it was cracked. And it was kind of like hidden because I think someone was like, oh, it's hidden. Like someone is not going to buy it. And then they forgot about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they had gone. And I was like, hey, they left this. Do you want this? And he was like, yeah. So, yeah. But that was Russian Doll. Before that, we had Hypsilene by La Femme off of Psychotropical Berlin. And then we had... Wait, I already talked about The Stallion, didn't I? Oh, yeah. We had Silly Drinks by Rosemother off of On to the Next. Big fan of Rosemother. but it is 4:30 officially, so we are going to hand it off to... What is that? It's called Book It. Book it.
Right?
Take it or leave it. Book it. Yeah, in all caps. But yeah, so to fade us out here, I'm going
to
play...
It's time for us to book it.
It is...
For now.
We're old news of the universe.
Yeah. Whoa.
Okay, I'm gonna put on 10-hour drive through West Coast Disaster, and that will be the last song. That's off Manzanita, Shani Cleveland's solo album. Thanks so much for listening to this show. I hope you've had the best time, and I hope you have a beautiful afternoon. Goodbye from me and Flemmy.
Bye.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm DJ Drainfield.
I'm Micah.
This is Bucket.
Yippee.
The number one show at KDVS.
Of course.
Point blank period.
So true.
This is KDVS Davis, and the following views presented this half hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. Micah.
Wow.
We read something this week.
We sure did. It's almost like we read every week or something. You know?
Well, I read every week.
I also read every week. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'll leave right now. I will leave this room right now.
I'm just kidding. We read something every week. Oh, my God.
DJ Drainfield reads every week.
I do. It's true. I agree.
I'm formally resigning from the show. This is my last day here. It was fun while it lasted. I'm quitting KDVS, stepping down from my position.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Cool.
What book did you read?
We read Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism by Vladimir Lenin. It was composed over the span of like 3 to 6 months in 1916.
Exile or something when you wrote this, or am I crazy?
I think he might have been. I think the timeline is right.
In like Sweden or something?
Yes, correct. He was in Sweden in exile. I don't remember. When was he in Sweden? Let's look that up.
Don't remember.
I believe he was in exile, though. I know State and Revolution, he wrote like right before the Russian Revolution. That's why he's like, oh, I make do a continuation of this. And then he didn't.
Awkward.
Because he went to war.
1927. I hate the 27 number.
I don't...
Got no clue.
I don't think he was in Sweden at this time.
Wow. I lied.
Yeah.
Or did I?
Oh, wait. 1917 is when he returned to Russia. So maybe... Yeah, I guess he wrote it while in exile.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, that's cool. But yeah, this book is a popular outline of the Lenin understanding of imperialism, as well as the late 19th century's developments of capitalism and how those fed into the 20th century post-World War I. Do you want to kind of get... I understand it was a dense reading, and your theory background is maybe...
Very poor.
Okay, I wasn't going to say poor, but...
I couldn't think of another word.
Yeah, you just don't have...
I have not read as much theory as you.
Yeah, you have less confidence in it. I think that's fair, right?
Yeah, like Oh, I thought we had a call. Yeah, no, I haven't read very much theory at all. And so, like I was saying earlier to DJ Drainfield, pre-show, I feel like I don't have, like, a strong foundation for any of this. So I can read it, but, like, I don't really know how to explain it or, like, kind of talk about it, just because, like I said, don't have the foundation for a lot of this stuff, and like, I don't know, I just feel like I can't freely like express opinion, you know what I mean? I don't know. Hopefully that makes sense to the listeners.
Yes.
But DJ Drainfield's our expert here.
I'm very far from an expert. I think if I were to say there's an expert at KDVS, it's our beloved DJ Sunday Green.
Yes, our goat.
But I am just a, you know, somewhat enjoyer of theory. I read theory outside of Book It, so I can hopefully walk us through this book a little bit, and as we walk through it, you and I can have some conversations.
I will try my best.
Cool. So the first chapter is called Concentration of Production and Monopolies. In this, Lenin articulates that as capitalism has developed, it's resulted in the perpetuation and expansion of monopolies and cartels within industries. He cites some early statistics of how large-scale enterprises host a disproportionate percentage of workers, as well as use a disproportionate percentage of electricity, etc. And this is to speak to how production within these capitalist states is primarily performed by a very small group of companies and firms. And so these monopolies then develop, and this results in finance capital. So that gets us into our second chapter. Before that, any thoughts on this first notion of monopolies? And I'll add that when he talks about monopolies, how, like, on a very basic level, we understand monopolies is like, oh, only one person owns the industry. But because of a lot of capitalist nations' antitrust laws that actively prevent this, monopolies can be defined within Lenin's workings as just like, there is a company, like there are other companies that are engaging in this industry, but it's very much dominated by one or a few in the form of a cartel. Cartel not being like a Mexican gang, but like...
Yeah, no, I was going to ask after you finished talking, what, like... When I was reading, I was kind of confused on what he meant by cartel. Like,
yeah, so a cartel is, the term predates, like, the name for the Mexican gang or, like, a poster in Spanish. A cartel is just, like, a term used to define multiple companies that occupy, or multiple firms that occupy and dominate an industry. So mm-hmm. like the oil cartel is a commonly used term even today in reference to the few companies that dominate the oil industry. He's not talking about gangs or anything like that. He's just talking about, like, I guess, like, an oligopoly, essentially. An oligopoly is, like, is like a monopoly, but it's explicitly from, like, a few, rather than mono being, like, from Latin, one, right? So an oligopoly just means multiple, but it's still occupied by a very small handful that dominate the industry. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sorry, I'm looking at your hand.
Oh, okay. Cool. So this monopolization of several industries within modern capitalism, modern capitalism being like the capitalism Lenin was writing during, so like 1916, 1917, but a lot of this holds true. I always like to say I feel like Lenin was writing 100 years in the future and 100 years in the past, because I think a lot of his fundamental ideas really, really hold true even in the present day. Out of these monopolies arises finance capital. Do you want to define capital within a Marxist sense for us, perhaps?
Me?
Yeah. Well, there's no one else in the room.
I know, but like, I don't think I know how to like.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
It's like, that's why I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, that's okay. So
I feel like I'm in class right now.
I'm sorry. Capital within a Marxist sense can be defined in multiple ways. Marx does not just define capital as money. Capital can be labor, right? The means by which production occurs. It can be a commodity. So like a piece of wood is capital. And then the finished commodity, like a pencil that comes from the wood, is also a form of capital. And so through this massive accumulation of wealth from these small industries, or from these like small or like large corporations that dominate these markets, finance capital emerges as a fundamental alliance between the banks and financial institutions and these industry heads and corporations. And so finance capital is essentially, how would you say, the circulation of liquid money through a system that is essentially a feedback loop between the banks and these industries, where the banks can invest their capital into these industries, have stake in them, whatever, and then these industries will then produce profit that then feeds back into the bank. So it's like a circular situation in which, through investment, the banks and these industries are expanding one another's wealth through finance capital. And in this process, it alters the bank's traditional relationship. When you think of a bank, you're probably thinking of, oh, I go to the bank, I drop off my money, they hold it for me, maybe they invest it or whatever. But that's the primary relationship. But the emergence of finance capital resulted in a shift in how these dynamics are understood, to the point in which banks, in many ways, have exerted a lot of influence over these industries and a lot of control. That's why a lot of people today in like the US would be like, the banks control everything, because in many ways they do. A lot of these financial holding companies like Sequoia, BlackRock, Vanguard, they all have significant stake in all of the major corporations you understand and know and use. And as a result, they can exert that influence however they deem profitable for them. So that's the banks and their new role, chapter two. Let's move on to, let's see. Okay, well, we kind of covered chapter two and chapter three. The banks have developed a new role within capitalism, and then that role has led to an alliance between the banks and financial oligarchies. So now we're kind of getting into the imperialism aspect of this, where essentially in this stage of capitalism, the major export was no longer commodities, but instead finance capital. So when you think about, let me think of a good example. There's a program in the U.S. called USAID, and it's where the U.S. will send money to Latin American countries and invest in, like, maybe they build them a library or a new road or a railroad or something like that. It's not always infrastructure. It can be maybe they invest in companies there. USAID won't, but, like, American firms. Actually, we'll stick it to private. So let me think of a good example for this. I'll just keep it general, actually. It's fine. Essentially, through this overproduction and surplus of capital that accumulated following the industrial and financial alliance that occurred following the development of monopolies within capitalism, they needed to do something with this money. So what was the natural progression for these capitalist nations? It was to export their finance capital into these other countries, like what we would consider the global south today, and exploit their land and their resources and their labor because it's far cheaper. And this was to little objection from, like, the people within these capitalist countries. Like, for example, France set up 1 million colonies within Africa, and they use those colonies to exploit the labor of these people and extract their resources. Michael Parenti has a really, really powerful quote where he says, "There's no such thing as a poor country. There are only overexploited countries." And that's to say that what we understand as poor countries today truly are not poor in the sense of they just live in a desert and there's nothing of value to be found there. A lot of these countries have some of the most plentiful and valuable natural land and resources. The problem is, it's these already capitalist nations that will then come and exert force and aggression over these nations and extract these resources. A good example, Israel's number one export, diamonds. Israel has no diamond mines. Where do those diamonds come from? They all come from, like, the Congo and these other African nations where they can just extract this wealth from them, underpay these people for their labor, and sell it within the global, like, North's markets, the first world, and derive significant profit from it. And so people in the U.S., for example, will not as frequently object to American imperialism that we see internationally because we reap the benefits of social welfare. Something you'll hear a lot, and that's why I like to say, like, Lenin talks about, like, 100 years in the future, because I think state and revolution has a lot to say about social democracy. And he's talking about the Mensheviks, but I think it was very applicable to, like, the Bernie Sanders AOC fold of American politics, as well as Scandinavian democratic socialism and, like, DSA in America. And I think this is especially relevant because I think that this democratic socialist fold within American politics loves to say, like, oh, we don't want Soviet socialism, we want Scandinavian socialism, like Norway and Sweden. But what Lenin is talking about here directly interacts with such ideas, and he's saying, these people in the global north do not care that their country is exploiting the global south because they reap the benefits of their social welfare programs. And so as a result, they become complicit in the imperialism of their nation, or in the imperialist activities of their nation, because they reap the profit from that imperial, of these imperial endeavors. Does that all make sense to you? Does that sound cool?
Yes, I think you explained all of that very well.
Awesome. So now chapter 5, the division of the world among capitalist powers, I believe can be summarized pretty easily. It's essentially just how we have always understood, like, the race for Africa, or, why is the name escaping me? It occurred in the 16th century. One second. Yeah. The Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, so not the 16th century, the 15th. It was essentially just like the Pope said, hey, Spain, you get this half of the world. Portugal, you get this half of the world. You both can exploit the resources of whatever and, like, set up your colonies. That's why there are Portuguese colonies in India and Spanish colonies in North America, stuff like that, because of just how the world was split. And so Lenin articulates that within an imperialist framework of capitalism, the world experiences divisions into colonies. And so we see the British taking the eastern coast of North America and the Spanish taking the western coast. And we see Portugal taking much of, like, Southern America, like Brazil, right? You want to correct me on that?
Yeah. Portugal only took Brazil, though.
Yeah.
Spain.
It's a significant chunk of South America.
Yeah.
Right. Spain took most of it. Like, well, that's why they all speak Spanish.
What? Yeah. Well, originally, Portugal took only the coast of what is now Brazil, because a majority of Brazil is just like Amazon rainforest, and that's where like they set up their sugarcane plantations and stuff like that.
That makes sense.
Yes.
But point being, we see like the French took much of Canada, you know?
True.
When you have these imperialist powers that all see the global south as, I guess, piggy banks to be exploited and resources to extract and labor to derive, they will chop up the world and create these spheres of influence and colonies. And Lenin articulates this fear. I think that it's kind of what we saw occurring within the Cold War, too, under the Soviet Union, where half of the world was under the American and British and French, like, Western sphere of influence, while the rest was under the Soviet sphere of influence. We see proxy wars arise from that. Not to say that the Soviet Union was necessarily capitalist, but I don't think Lenin would believe the Soviet Union was necessarily fully socialist either, in some regards. It's a complicated conversation. I think that can be discussed later. But
on Concrete, Concrete, Concrete.
Yeah. Feel free to hear about that on Concrete, Concrete, Concrete. And Lenin says, now the world has been divided in the late 19th century, with Britain and France taking the majority of this land and Germany also taking some of it, but being late to the scene. And as a result, it's now a race between these imperial powers to extract the resources of the world for their personal gain, all through financial capital, which he outlines earlier. Chapter 7 is Lenin essentially criticizing Kautsky's conception of imperialism, where he articulates imperialism as an explicitly political activity. And I think this is consistent for Lenin across all of his writings that I've read, at least, where he communicates that there is an inextricable relationship or inextricable ties between politics and economics, or you cannot fundamentally separate capitalism from policy. And so while imperialism may function as policy in some regards, it has a fundamental economic basis insofar as imperialism is the act of exporting finance capital to derive wealth from other nations. And so he's essentially saying, hey, Kautsky, it's not just policy. This is also economic. You cannot ignore the role capitalism plays and how the emergence of monopolies directly results in imperialism. And that's essentially what that chapter is. Chapter 8. This is Lenin just kind of getting into the parasitism of imperialism on the global southern countries. And also, please stop me whenever there's something you want to add to the discussion. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I feel like you're doing a really good job of explaining all of it. Also, I think right around here is where I started getting, or started falling off.
I think so. Part of this parasitism is Lenin's argument is that through imperialism, from these monopolistic industries and cartels, they become so extremely wealthy within their capitalist nations through the export of finance capital that it results in there's the common argument that capitalism like drives innovation. Lenin's point is that when you are so rich and when you dominate an industry so significantly that you have such security within your standing, that even these like massive corporations will no longer invest in technological innovation or development of their commodity. Instead, they'll prioritize simply just continuing to profit. And that can really easily be done by exporting their commodity to the global south as well. Because the global south, while there's finance capital being exported and resources and labor being extracted from these countries, they still, in some regards, have like a greater inflow of capital to them from these other countries, even if it's not as much capital as they should be deriving. And as a result, like, consumption can be done in these countries as well. Like, the third world will consume American products and goods all the time, even if it's very expensive for them to consume. Next, Lenin gets into the critiques of imperialism from typically liberal and bourgeois perspectives. So from the perspective of the bourgeois to Lenin, he says the only primary critique that they will have, because they are the main profiteers of imperialism, not necessarily directly like finance capital's export, because they may not work for a bank, but they still will profit from it because of their investment in a firm. And we already articulated the cyclical dynamic between finance, institutions, and industry. And so their only complaint for imperialism will not be what it's actually doing, but rather the violent nature in which imperialism takes form. Like, we see America send their troops all over the world to just kind of take wealth. Like, we saw in Iraq, they deployed a significant amount of troops to extract oil. This is no surprise. And even the bourgeois can critique this, though they won't necessarily say this shouldn't be happening, just it should be happening peacefully. Lenin also mentions that petty bourgeois democratic opposition may occur, but that's because it contradicts their values of freedom, democracy, and competition as alternatives to imperialism. However, Lenin's argument is that rather than saying imperialism should be done away with because it's a product of monopolies, rather than doing away with imperialism and replacing it with the precursor of like laissez-faire capitalism and unrestricted capitalism, he says this should be replaced by socialism, because capitalism will ultimately find its way back into a form of monopolies and exploitation, versus socialism, which on its own will provide for the basic needs of people on a fundamental level, while also being gets into State and Revolution, a different Lenin reading. But in it, he articulates the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat in collective ownership of the people of the state. And he says this is a far greater alternative. It's far less exploitative, and it would result in less, how would you say, destruction within the global south and within these exploited nations. So now we get to the final chapter. We're actually making pretty good time right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chapter 10, The Place of Imperialism in History. In this, he's essentially just outlining the history of it and how monopolies and oligarchical power have manifested and resulted in the development of banks into the arbiters of finance capital, and this exchange that occurs between these banks and these monopolies and cartels, and additionally how this excess and surplus of finance capital and production results in the export of finance capital to the global south, which then manifests itself into imperialism, which then results in essentially everything we've been talking about for the last half an hour, so it's feeling redundant. But then he talks about how advanced capitalist nation states and cartels will continue to exploit even their own citizens and resources, while creating a parasitic relationship working off of the global south, and how these dynamics will ultimately just drive up prices while not reducing or increasing the value of labor, the price for labor within these capitalist nations. And this leads to disgruntlement within these societies that then results in the use of force to maintain and protect the private interests of these nations, while the exploited nations continue to be unable to achieve meaningful development due to their consistent and frequent exploitation from the parasitic nature of imperialism. That brings us into our last minute. But that was the quick summary of Imperialism, The High Stage of Capitalism by Vladimir Lenin. A very good book, in my opinion. I quite enjoyed reading it. I've read it before, but I quite enjoy it. I think Lenin has a lot of really powerful and important ideas, especially when we consider how pervasive imperialism is and its role within all popular modern geopolitical topics. Like, you can't talk about Israel and Palestine without talking about imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst many other things. But with that, do you want to intro our next book?
Oh my gosh. I also want to say I did enjoy this as well. I think I just need to reread it again. I've only read it once, so. Anyways, next week, It's going to be so fire. We're going to be reading Sun and Steel by Yukio Mishima, my personal goat. Favorite author. Don't approve anything else he's done, I will say.
Is it an autobiography?
I think so. I think it kind of is. I don't really know. I think so, honestly. I don't know. I don't think it's nonfiction. Or not nonfiction.
You don't think fiction, it's
fiction? Fiction. Sorry,
gotcha.
Sorry.
All right. Well, that's our show. We'll be back in a week.
It's going to be crazy.
Our review of Sun and Steel. Micah will take the lead on that one.
I'm going to lock in.
It'll be very exciting. Yeah. But up next is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Please feel free to stay tuned to KDVS Davis. Bye for now.
Bye.
Look out now, this is the Diz, Dizzy Gillespie that is, and let me give you some information. If you want to hear some good sounds, the sounds that's round, keep your radio tuned to KDVS in Davis, 90.3 on your FM dial. Look out. Ow. This is the Diz signing off.
Welcome to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks very much for tuning in to your local campus and community radio station on a Wednesday afternoon in the middle of July. I'm happy to have you here. You know, for the last 24 years, I've delved deep into the dungeon of Freeborn Hall. A building that, if you read last week's Sacramento News and Review story on this subject, is not long for this world. It's true, I've been sitting at this same seat, at this same desk for the last quarter century, but soon upgraded equipment, upgraded microphones, and upgraded above-the-ground Wi-Fi available location at the UC Davis campus for your favorite campus and community radio station, a headquarters for freeform music, where DJs get to choose the tunes. Unaffiliated and uncontrolled by our corporate music choosing overlords. It's same with this radio show. You know, no one, when I started this show in the year 2000, no one was clamoring for a poetry and technology radio show, especially not one that lasted an hour, not one hosted by some sort of airy, rarefied, I'm trying to find another rhyming word in my head for that, academic named Dr. Andy, who was teaching T.S. Eliot classes, writing classes, freshman seminars, teaching undergrads how to get into graduate school back in the late 90s. Remember the 90s? No one was asking for that. But still, they got it.